They stop. Jules looks miserable. But they are nearly there. The point where Joseph would have sailed around Cape Horn, and where the storm might have come upon him. We take to the woods now, Arsinoe says.
Why's that? Billy asks.
You'll see. She swings into the saddle and turns around to face the spires of the Volroy. Indra Down is her sister's city, for now. And as such, Arsinoe is forbidden to enter without an invitation. But after Beltane, that will change, and if she ascends, those spires will be hers, even though it makes her dizzy just to look at them. They ride fast through the maze of cobblestone streets, out to where the roads change to gravel, and then to dirt, until they jump the last ditch and disappear into the trees. The going is slower in the forest, and the Indra Down horses do not like it, fancy jet-black things that they are, but Jules manages to keep them moving. Camden is tired, and rides draped across the front of Jules's saddle, massive and purring and clinging to the horse's neck. It is a testament to the strength of Jules's gift that her horse does not drop dead from fright.
We should have kept the roads, Billy says.
No one answers, and he says no more. Since they left Wolf Spring, no one has said what they all know to be true. If Joseph went into the frigid water, he is gone, dead within minutes, and no amount of searching will bring him back. They will know soon. If Arsinoe's spell leads them to the water's edge, they will know for sure. When they step into a clearing large enough to hold them all, and a fire besides, Arsinoe halts her mount. All right, she says. Let's gather wood.
Gather wood? We've only just started on these horses, says Billy.
Arsinoe pulls together fallen branches. The fire does not need to last long. Jules strips birch bark with her knife and drops a mound of white and peach-colored curls over the top of the pile. She kneels beside the fire as Arsinoe lights the match. Are you going to need my hair? Jules asks. Arsinoe looks at her, surprised. But of course she knows. Jules has always been able to read her better than anyone else. Arsinoe reaches into her leather bag and pulls out the small silver blade. She takes it from its sheath. It is slightly curved, sharp and mean-looking, and longer than their common knives by half. She takes out the clothes of Joseph's that she brought and sets the knife on top of them.
What's going on? Billy asks. What are you doing?
Arsinoe feeds the fire up higher with dry weeds and small twigs. There is no one around for a long way in all directions. They passed no fences coming in and heard no barking dogs. It is windless and a little warm and eerily silent, except for the pop and crackle of burning wood. Jules rolls up her sleeve.
I thought you made flowers bloom and forced cougars to balance books on their heads, Billy whispers.
Jules doesn't force that cat to do anything. Arsinoe grabs the knife and searches through the pile of clothes with the tip. And she can make flowers bloom. Not me, though. All I've got is this.
Low magic, Jules explains.
Magic for the giftless. Arsinoe grabs Joseph's shirt and tears a strip from the bottom with her teeth.
Why do I not like the sound of that? Billy asks. Why does it seem like you've kept it a secret?
Because I have, Arsinoe says.
Because it lies, says Jules. Because it kicks back.
Then why are you using it now? Asks Billy.
Arsinoe tilts the knife back and forth.
Do you want to find Joseph or not?
Jules watches it fearfully as it wags in Arsinoe's hand. She is never fooled about with low magic, not even as a child, when many of the island grew curious. Low magic is not something to be played at. It is not owned, like a gift is. It is something let off its leash. The priestesses of the temple sometimes call it a sideways prayer. Perhaps answered, and perhaps not, but always with a price.
All right, Jules says and holds her hand out.
Wait, Billy says, before Arsinoe can make a single cut. Joseph wouldn't want you to do this. He wouldn't approve of it.
I know. but he would do it for me, if I were the one who was missing.
Close your eyes, Arsinoe says. Think of Joseph. Think of nothing else but Joseph.
Jules nods. Arsinoe takes a steady breath and cuts into the meat of Jules's hand, into the soft mound of flesh just above her thumb. Thin red blood runs in stripes, circling around to drip to the ground. Arsinoe slices carefully, carving out the elaborate web of symbols that Madrigal showed her. She holds Jules' hand above Joseph's shirt.
Squeeze.
Jules closes her fingers. Blood drizzles onto the fabric. When there is enough, Arsinoe drops the bloody mess onto the fire and quickly binds Jules' cuts with the strip of cloth she tore.
Breathe the smoke.
Did you take too much blood?
Jules asks.
I don't feel right. My eyes.
Don't be afraid. Think of Joseph.
The smoke smells acrid from the burning blood. Arsinoe and Billy watch with morbid fascination as Jules breathes it in, and the spell inside it hollows her out. It makes of Jules a vacant vessel for whatever the smoke desires. If Arsinoe has done everything right, what it will desire is Joseph.
Is she all right? Billy asks.
She will be, Arsinoe says, though truly, she does not know.
It does not matter now.
It is too late to turn back. Arsinoe and Billy lead the horses in Jules' wake as she lumbers jerkily through the trees. It is not easy. The horses are skittish and nervous without Jules's gift to calm them, and they are afraid of the thing that Jules has become. Magic encased in skin, with no person left inside.
What are you doing to her?
Billy whispers.
I am not doing anything to her, Arsinoe replies. She's looking for Joseph.
It is looking for Joseph.
It is not Jules.
But when he is found, it will let Jules go. Or so she hopes. Camden bumps against Arsinoe's leg and grunts nervously. The spell seems to have made the cougar slightly ill. She does not want to be near the shell that is and is not Jules, and stays close to Arsinoe and the horses.
Billy looks from the cat to Arsinoe.
How long have you been doing that? He asks, and jerks his head over his shoulder.
Why?
Because I don't think you know quite how to do it, he says. The corners of his mouth turn in a disappointed frown. Arsinoe punches him in the arm.
It's working, isn't it? And besides, I don't think that you are exactly the best person to judge.
Jules told her that Joseph thought Billy was already half in love with her, but he is not. Arsinoe sees through him, all the way down to his father's darker designs. He will marry the queen for the crown. But it has been pleasant, becoming his friend. And it is not as if she does not understand his reasons.
Ahead, Jules moans. Then she half shouts and breaks toward the coast, toward the water.
Arsinoe looks at Billy nervously, and he squeezes her shoulder. A moment later, Jules changes direction and darts straight ahead. Arsinoe shoves her horse's reins into Billy's hands.
Take them, she sputters. Cam, with me.
The cougar needs no more encouragement. She seems to sense that Jules is returning to herself. Her ears prick forward, and she purrs as they run together after Jules. Joseph and Mirabella walk hand in hand. Even after spending a long morning beside a fire, they have to be nearing the capital. No matter how slow they walk, they must soon part. Neither can put it off any longer. Joseph will return to Wolf Spring, to his girl, and to where he belongs, and this strange interlude will be over, but not forgotten.
It is foolish to be sad, Mirabella said the night before, as they lay together.
Things are the way they are. Even if you were free, I could never keep you. Mirabella freezes at a movement in the trees, and Joseph steps protectively in front of her. Perhaps it is a search party from Roland. She almost hopes so. Then they will drag her off and she will not have to walk away from him of her own accord. A girl's cry sounds through the woods. Joseph's fingers slip from hers.
Jules? He calls out. Jules!
He looks back at Mirabella, perhaps with regret. Then he runs through the trees.
Mirabella follows at a safe distance, just close enough to see the girl who crashes through the leaves, running through low brush like an animal.
Joseph!
The girl throws herself against his chest with no grace, and he wraps his arms around her. She sobs, very loud sobs for a body so small.
Your mother had a dream, she says. I was so afraid.
I am fine, Jules. He kisses her head. She jumps up and presses her lips to his. Mirabella's heart feels as if it is hanging on the outside of her chest. She shrinks back into the trees as Joseph kisses this girl he has loved his whole life. Something else shakes the brush, and a large golden cat jumps up on them both. Mirabella watches as they pet and stroke the cougar. They are naturalists, then, and such a strong familiar is befitting a queen. Arsinoe must be near. Arsinoe, her sister. And then she sees her, running up with a grin that Mirabella recognizes, her short hair flying over her shoulders. Mirabella wants to shout. She wants to hold her arms wide open, but she is too afraid to move. It has been so long since she has seen Arsinoe, but she is just the same. There are even shadows of dirt on her impish face. Through the trees, another boy approaches, leading three horses, perhaps an attendant.
We thought you were dead, Arsinoe says.
I see that. You didn't even bother to bring a fourth horse.
Everyone laughs except the girl, Jules. That is not funny. Yet, she says. They do not see Mirabella. She watches them embrace and listens to their laughter. But no matter how many times she opens her mouth, she cannot find the courage to speak. Instead, she ducks behind a tree and suffers quietly. It will not be long before they walk away. Arsinoe breathes a sigh of relief, watching Jules and Joseph embrace. Jules is herself again. The moment she saw Joseph, the spell released her.
Are you hurt? Billy calls from farther back.
The horses are still nervous, and he has his hands full trying to hold them steady.
No, says Joseph. But the boat's gone. I got caught in the squall and it went under. I barely made it to the shore. I thought I taught you to sail better than that, Billy says and laughs.
You didn't teach him to sail at all, Arsinoe says over her shoulder. He's been on the boat since he was old enough to walk.
Jules, Joseph looks down at her hand, wrapped in blood-soaked cloth.
What happened?
Later, Arsinoe interjects. Isn't it enough that you are not drowned? And we ought to get you out of these woods and over a hot plate of food.
You're right, says Joseph. He puts an arm around Jules. As he does, he glances back into the trees. Arsinoe's eyes follow, and she sees a flash of black skirt. As they leave the meadow, she discreetly drops her knife. It is easy enough to pretend to notice it missing a moment later and go back for it alone.
Mirabella does not hear anything before Arsinoe steps around the tree trunk, not so much as a snapping twig.
Arsinoe!
You're not very good at hiding, Arsinoe says. Those lovely black skirts of yours are sticking out all over.
Mirabella stiffens at the tone of Arsinoe's voice. Her eyes flicker to Arsinoe's hand, curled around the handle of a knife. Everyone told her that her sisters were weak, that killing them would be easy. But it does not feel easy. So far, Arsinoe is much better at this game.
What are you doing here? Arsinoe asks.
I do not know, says Mirabella. She sounds like a fool. When she left Roland, she never imagined she would meet one of her sisters and hear her voice. But here they are, together, as if they were lead.
You have grown tall, Mirabella says.
Arsinoe snorts. Tall.
Do you remember me?
I know who you are.
That is not what I asked, says Mirabella. It is hard to believe how much she wants to reach out to Arsinoe. She had not realized until this moment how much she has missed her. She takes a half step forward. Arsinoe steps back and tightens her grip on the knife.
That is not why I am here, Mirabella says. I don't care why you're here.
You do not remember, then, says Mirabella.
That is all right.
I remember enough for us both, and I will tell you if you will listen.
Listen to what?
Arsinoe's eyes dart suspiciously to the shadows of the trees. The naturalists have taught her to be afraid. They have taught her to hate, just as the temple has tried to teach Mirabella.
But it has all been lies.
Mirabella holds out her hand. She does not know what she will do if Arsinoe takes it, but she has to try.
Hoofbeats rumble.
Arsinoe steps back as riders burst through the trees. They are not alone anymore. Armed priestesses close in on them, circling and circling.
What is this? Arsinoe growls. An ambush?
She glances at the knife in her hand as if considering taking Mirabella hostage.
Jules!
She shouts instead.
Jules!
It is only moments before the girl and the cougar bound into the clearing, with Joseph close behind. But they are cut off. The priestesses use their mounts to push them into a tight group.
No, Arsinoe, Mirabella starts.
Queen Mirabella!
Mirabella scowls.
It is Ro, seated astride a tall white horse.
She holds the reins in one hand. In the other, she carries one of the long serrated knives of the temple.
Are you injured?
No, I am fine. I am safe. Stop this!
Ro charges the horse in between the sisters so violently that Arsinoe falls back onto the leaves.
Ro, stop!
No,
Ro says. She drags Mirabella up into the saddle, in front of her, as though she weighs nothing.
It is too soon for this, she says loudly. Not even you can break the rules. Save your killing for after the quickening.
On the ground, Arsinoe glares up at her. Mirabella shakes her head, but it is no good. Ro signals to the priestesses, and they gallop off together, veering north and leaving Arsinoe and Joseph far behind.
The High Priestess is not pleased with you, my queen,
Ro says into Mirabella's ear.
You should not have run away.
Starfall Lake. Luca meets Sarah Westwood on the bank of Starfall Lake. It is far inland from Rolanth, a large, deep lake with more width than length. It is where the Blue Heron River originates and where they brought Mirabella to meet Luca for the first time. It is a long way to come for a pot of tea and a cooling lunch, but at least there are fewer ears pressed against doors to hear what they are saying. Sarah greets the High Priestess and bows. More gray has come into her hair this year, and there are faint lines in the corners of her eyes. By the end of the ascension, Sarah may become an old woman.
Has there been no word? She asks.
Nothing yet, says Luca. But Ro will find her.
Sarah stares out across the steely blue lake.
Our Mira, she says sadly. I did not know she was unhappy. After she first came to us, I never expected she would begin to hide her emotions. What if she is hurt?
She is not hurt. The goddess will protect her.
But what will we do? Sarah asks. I do not know how much longer we can keep this secret. The servants begin to suspect.
They will have no proof once Mirabella is returned.
Do not worry. No one will ever know that she was gone.
What if it is not Ro who locates her? What if...
Luca grasps her arm. If the High Priestess's touch has been good for anything, it has always been good at stemming panic. And Luca has no time for panic today. She did not ask Sarah to come all this way, just to calm her fears. She leads Sarah up the bank, to a copse of evergreens and a large stone, dark and weathered and flat as a table. Her priestesses have set it with tea and bread and soup, reheated over a small cooking fire. Luca readies her old bones and climbs onto the rock. She is pleased to discover it is not a difficult climb, and they have set out a pillow for her along with a soft folded blanket.
Will you sit with me? She asks.
And eat?
I will eat, Sarah says, looking gravely at the stone table.
But I will not sit, High Priestess, if it is all the same to you.
Why not?
That stone is sacred, Sarah explains. Elemental priestesses once sacrificed hares on it and threw their hearts into the lake.
Luca runs her hand across the rock. It seems more than just a rock now, knowing all the blood it has drunk.
And it is not only rabbit's blood, it is tasted, she is sure.
So many things on the island are more than what they seem. So many places where the goddess's eye is always open.
It is fitting that Luca has come to this one, to discuss the sacrifice of queens.
Luca tears the bread in half and hands a piece to Sarah. It is good, soft bread, with an oat crust, but Sarah does not take a bite. She worries it between her fingers until it turns to crumb.
I never thought she would do something like this, Sarah says. She has always been so dutiful.
Not always, Luca notes, and chews. There was a time when Mirabella listened to no one, and nothing. But that was long ago, and far away from the dignified young queen she has become.
What are we to do?
Luca swallows her tea and fights the urge to slap Sarah across the face. Sarah is a good woman and her friend these many years, but there is no firmness in her jaw. It will take a backbone of steel to hold together a black council led by her. Sometimes Luca pities the High Priestess who comes after, for she will be the one who has to do it.
What are we to do? Luca says.
Indeed.
Tell me, Sarah, what do you know about the white-handed queens?
They are blessed, she says hesitantly. Fourth-borns.
Yes, but not only that. A queen is said to be white-handed any time her sisters are killed by means other than her own doing. Be that by being drowned by the midwife before they come of age, or put to death for some unfortunate curse, or,
Luca says slowly,
being sacrificed by the island for the one true queen.
I had not heard of that, says Sarah.
It is an old legend, or at least I thought it was only a legend, something of a whisper about the sacrificial years. It is so old it is no wonder we have overlooked the signs.
What signs?
The weakness of Arsinoe and Catarine, the boundless strength of Armira, and of course Mirabella's own reluctance to kill.
Luca presses her hand to her forehead.
I am ashamed to say that all this time I thought that her only flaw.
I do not understand, Sarah says. You believe that Mirabella is reluctant to kill because she is meant to be white-handed? And Arsinoe and Catarine will be sacrificed?
They are made as sacred offerings on the night of the quickening.
Luca drums her fingers on the stone. It vibrates deep down, like a heartbeat.
These are old tales, she says. Tales that tell of a queen born much stronger than her sisters. The only true queen born to that cycle. On the night of the quickening, the people recognize this and feed the other queens into the fires.
Luca waits, tensely. Sarah does not speak for a long time. She stands still, her hands clasped piously over her stomach.
That would be much easier, she says finally, and Luca relaxes.
Sarah's eyes are downcast. But whether she truly believes the tale does not matter.
Roe is right. Sarah will do as the temple bids.
Do not burden yourself, Luca says. What comes to pass will come to pass. It is only that I would see the island prepared. You have always been a strong voice for the temple, Sarah. It would be best if the people began to hear of this before they must watch it happen.
Sarah nods. She will be as good at spreading their tale as she has been at expanding Mirabella's fame. By the night of the quickening, the people will be waiting and wondering. Perhaps they will pick up the knives themselves. One of the novice priestesses approaches to warm their cups with fresh tea. Through the folds of her robes, Luca glimpses the silver of the temple's long, serrated blades. Come Beltane, every faithful priestess will carry one. It is not a lie, Ro told her. It is part truth, and it is for the good of the island. Someone must take things in hand, if their chosen queen will not. After the quickening ceremony, when the crowd at Beltane is drunk and in ecstasy from Mirabella's performance, the priestesses will step forward to take Arsinoe's and Katarine's heads. They will cut them at the necks and sever the arms at the shoulders. And when it is over, they will have a new queen. Greavesdrake Manor. The Aarons welcome the Chatworth delegation the only way they know how, with a party, though not a great glittering party in the North Ballroom. While there is plenty that glitters, the party they throw for the Chatworth boy is meant to be an introduction between the Queen and her potential King Consort. They will hold this meeting in the small dining room on the second floor, where it can be more intimate, and where Katarine can be placed at the heart, like a centerpiece. It is exciting to have the house prepared for a party again, and filling up with people. Cousin Lucian has returned with servants from his household, and he bows whenever he sees Katarine in the halls. There is a curious smile on his face when he does it, and she cannot decide whether the joke is with her or on her. Unfortunately, the return of people to Greavesdrake also meant the return of Genevieve, who has taken her exile very personally. As the younger sister, she hates when Natalia excludes her, and since her return has insisted on being involved in every aspect of the planning. My scalp is still sore from so many styles braided into it, Katarine says, leaning back against Peter. They have hidden themselves away in the stacks of the library, one of the few places she can be alone with Peter since Genevieve returned. Poor Giselle's fingers must ache as well, she continues. Genevieve is never pleased with my hair. Your hair is beautiful, says Peter. It is perfect. Genevieve had ordered braid after braid and bun after bun. She ordered beads of jet and pearl to be woven in, only to tear them out again. And all that just to declare that Katarine's neck is still too thin, and she should wear her hair down to hide it. Sometimes I think that she wants me to fail, Katarine whispers. Do not listen to her, Peter says, and kisses a sore red scab near her temple. After the suitor has gone, Natalia will order her back to her house in the city. You will not have to see her again until Beltane. She twists in his arms to kiss him. You must kiss the Chatworth boy just like that, he says. It will be difficult to find the right moment during this small, ill-conceived dinner party, but there will be a time when you can steal away. What if I do not like him? You may grow to. But if you do not, it does not matter. You are the queen, and must have your choice of consorts. He touches her cheek, and then lifts her chin. He would not see any of the delegates ensnared by Mirabella, and neither would she. William Chatworth Jr. is a handsome enough boy. His looks are not striking, like Peter's, but he has strong shoulders, a solid jawline, and very short hair the color of wet sand. His eyes are an unremarkable shade of brown, but they are steady, even seated as he is in the midst of a poisoner's dinner party. He came alone, without his mother or even his father, and with only two attendants as an escort. From the tense look on his face, it was not his idea. He has been thrown into the wolves' den. But there are worse houses for a mainlander to stumble into. Many of the Aarons have had close contact with the last King Consort. Of all the families on the island, they have the most knowledge of the mainland and its customs. Aside from a stiff bow and an introduction,
He and Katarine have not spoken. He has spent most of the evening talking with Cousin Lucien, but now and again, Katarine raises her head and finds him studying her. The meal is served, seared pink medallions of meat with a sliver of golden baked potato tart, untainted, of course. The errands do their best to look impressed, though only those who are terribly hungry will do more than pick at it. Genevieve takes Katarine by the arm and digs her fingers in deep. "Do not make a pig of yourself," she says, "just because there is no poison in it." To further make the point, she twists the skin inside Katarine's elbow. It hurts so badly that Katarine nearly cries out. Tomorrow, there will be a dark black bruise to be covered by sleeves and gloves. Across the table, Peter watches with a tightened jaw. He looks ready to leap across their dinner plates and wrap his hands around Genevieve's neck. Katarine catches his eye, and he seems to relax. He was right, after all. It is only until the Chatworth boy leaves. Then Genevieve will be banished again. After the dinner is over, with the food pushed back and forth to appear as though eaten, Natalia moves the party into the drawing room. Edmund serves the digestif, which must be poisoned, for the errands flock to it, like birds to a crust of bread. A maid carries a silver tray with a green bottle and two glasses. Something special for the queen and her suitor. "Let me," Katarine says. She takes the bottle by the neck and the glasses by the stems. Across the room, Cousin Lucien sees her coming and bows away from the Chatworth boy's side. "Will you take a drink, William Jr.?" she asks. "Of course, Queen Katarine." She pours for them both, and the champagne sparkles and fizzes. "You may call me Katarine if you'd like," she says, "or even only Cat. I know that the full title can be a mouthful." "I'm not used to saying it," he says. "I should have practiced. There will be plenty of time for that. And please call me Billy, or William. Some folk here have taken to calling me Junior, but I would rather it didn't spread."
It is a strange custom, naming the child the same as the parent, almost as if the parent hopes to one day inherit the body. They chuckle together.
"According to my father, a fine enough name can be used again," he says.
Katarine laughs. She looks around the room. Everyone is watching us and pretending that they are not. "I would not have chosen to meet you this way."
"Oh," he says. "What way would you have preferred?"
"On a trail somewhere, on a fine spring day. On horses, so that you would have to prove your mettle by catching me."
"You don't think that my coming here on my own proves my mettle?"
"That is true," she says. "It most certainly does." He is nervous and drinking fast. Katarine refills his glass.
"The Aarons have lived here a long time," he says,
and Katarine nods. "The Aarons are entrenched at Greavesdrake, and it is more than their poisons and their morbid artwork on the walls. Still lifes of butchered meat and flowers and black snakes curled around nudes. They have seeped into the manor itself. Now every inch of wood and shadow is also a part of them."
"Of course, the Aarons' ancestral estate lies in Prynne," Katarine says. "Greavesdrake Manor is the rightful home of the stewards of the queen, and it goes as the queen goes."
"You mean that if Arsinoe becomes queen, the Malones would live here?"
Billy closes his mouth quickly over the question, as if he has been instructed not to mention her sister's names.
"Yes," Katarine replies. "Do you think they would like it? Do you think it would suit them?"
"No,"
he answers and raises his eyes to the high ceilings, the tall windows obscured with velvet drape.
"I think they'd be more likely to live in tents in the yard."
Katarine blurts laughter, real laughter, and her eyes find Peter's out of guilt. He has drawn away into the far corner, pretending to listen to the council concerns of Renata Hargrove and Margaret Bolin, but the whole time watching Katarine jealously. She does not want to think so, but it would be easier if Peter were not there at all.
"Billy," she says, "would you care to see more of the manor?"
"It would be a pleasure."
No one objects when they move into the hall together, though there is a momentary hush in the already hushed conversation. The second they are free of the drawing room, Catherine takes a great, heaving sigh. When the mainlander looks at her strangely, she blushes. "Sometimes I think I have had so much ceremony I could scream," she says. He smiles. "I know what you mean." She does not think that he does. But he will, soon enough. The entire Beltane festival is one ritual after another, the hunt, the disembarking, and the quickening. His poor mainland mind will addle, trying to remember all the rules and decorum. "There will be no break from it, I suppose," he says. "Not even from meetings of this kind." "How many suitors will there be, Queen Catherine?"
"I do not know," she says. "Once, there were many. But now Natalia thinks it will only be 6 or 7. But even that number seems a burden when she thinks of Peter. How can she ask him to stand aside and watch? It is what he says he wants, but she knows that he is lying."
"You don't sound excited," Chatworth says. "None of you queens seems to want to be courted. The girls I know back home would go mad to receive so many suitors."
Catherine tries to smile. She is letting it slip, leaving him open to be snatched up by Mirabella and the Westwoods. She forces herself to step in close and to tilt her face up to his. When she kisses him, his lips are warm. He moves them against hers, and she almost pulls away. She will never be lost in him, the way she is in Peter. There is no point even in hoping. She will have many more moments like this when she is queen. Passionless moments spent silently screaming until she can return to Peter.
"That was lovely," Chatworth says.
"Yes, it was." They smile awkwardly. He did not sound like he meant it any more than she did. But they lean forward anyway, to do it again.
Wolf Spring. "You hate her, don't you?" Joseph asks, sitting with Arsinoe at the Malone's kitchen table as Madrigal washes fresh rune cuts on Arsinoe's hand. They are all the way up her wrist now, with bloodletting wounds on the inside of each arm.
"Mirabella, you mean?" Arsinoe asks. "Of course I hate her."
"But why, when you don't even know her?"
For a moment, in the forest when Mirabella held out her hand, she almost made Arsinoe believe something different. And then the priestesses came, looking more like soldiers than temple servants, and whatever flicker was there vanished. Her sister is cunning and strong. She came very close. It must take all those soldiers to keep her in check, to keep her from stealing away and killing her sisters too soon.
"I don't think it is strange at all," Arsinoe says. "Don't you see? It has to be one of us. It has to be her. My whole life I have heard that it has to be her, that I have to die so that she can lead, that I do not matter because she's here."
Across the kitchen, Grandma Kate throws a towel over her shoulder, shooing off her crow, who flies into another room and returns with a jar of salve. She lands on the table and knocks it against the wood.
"I'm not touching that," says Madrigal. "It's oily and it smells."
"I'll do it then," Kate says gruffly, and uses the same towel to shoo her daughter out of her chair.
Kate's hands on Arsinoe's wounds are rough as she works the salve into the cuts. Rough, because they are worried, but she says nothing. No one has said anything about Arsinoe's use of low magic. Since it brought Joseph home, even Jules has kept her mouth shut. It is not in Kate's nature to hold her tongue, but chastising Arsinoe would do no good. She has been indulged for too long and has become used to doing as she pleases.
"You ought to let this air a while before you wrap it up again."
Kate holds Arsinoe's hand a moment and then pats it firmly and sets it on the table. Arsinoe frowns. The Malones have loved her well, but they have loved her as one loves a doomed thing. Only Jules ever thought differently. And now Madrigal.
"I don't suppose it matters that none of those things are Mirabella's fault," Joseph says, and Kate smacks him with her towel.
Stop defending that queen, Joseph Sandrin, she snaps.
But she saved my life.
Is that all it takes to buy your loyalty?
Kate asks, and Joseph and Arsinoe smile.
Joseph stands when Jules comes through the front door. He leans down and kisses Arsinoe on the forehead.
You saved me too, he says. You found me.
He rests his hand on Arsinoe's shoulder.
But I don't want to see any more cuts on Jules. Do you understand?
Not even if you go missing again?
Not even then.
She harumphs.
You sound like a temple acolyte.
Maybe so, he says. But there are worse things to sound like.
Arsinoe does not see Jules again until much later, when Jules slips into their shared bedroom, with Camden behind her. Were it not for the sad dragging of the mountain cat's tail, Arsinoe might never have known that something was wrong.
Jules, are you just coming back?
Yes. Did I wake you? Arsinoe sits up and searches her bedside table until she finds her matches. She lights the candle to see Jules's troubled face.
I wasn't sleeping that well anyhow.
Arsinoe holds her hand out to Camden, but the big cat only groans.
What's the matter? Has something happened?
No, I don't know.
Jules climbs into her bed without changing clothes.
I think that something might have happened with Joseph.
What do you mean?
He's different since the accident.
Jules sits back quietly against her pillows and Camden jumps up to lie beside her and rests her large paws on her shoulder.
Do you think, Jules starts, do you think something could have happened with your sister?
My sister? Arsinoe repeats.
Jules almost never refers to the other queens that way. It sounds near accusatory, though Arsinoe cannot believe that is how she means it.
No, never. You are imagining things.
He keeps finding ways to mention her, Jules says.
Only because she saved him.
They were together for 2 nights. An uncomfortable ball forms in Arsinoe's gut. She wishes that Jules would stop talking about this. She does not want to know it.
That doesn't mean anything. She was likely using him to find me. Perhaps she even sent the storm.
Maybe, says Jules.
Have you asked him? Arsinoe asks, and Jules shakes her head. Then ask. I'm sure he will tell you there was nothing. Joseph has been waiting for you for years. He would never.
Arsinoe pauses and glances down the hall toward Madrigal's room. When Joseph came home, they had worked a spell, soaked in her blood and then knotted together. But she had destroyed it before it could be finished. Or at least, she thought she had.
Sleep, Jules, Arsinoe says and puts out the light. It will be better in the morning.
That night, neither girl sleeps well. Jules and Camden compete for space in the bed, grunting and pushing at each other with paws and knees. Arsinoe listens to the rustle of blankets for a long time. When she finally closes her eyes, her dreams are of Joseph, drowning in a blood-red sea. In the morning, Kate sends Jules and Arsinoe down into town, on orders to procure proper festival clothes. Gowns, she said, and grimaced when she said it. Kate, like Arsinoe, has no use for gowns. The brown and green wool dresses she wears to tend her household are all she needs. But even she will need one. This Beltane will be the Elder Malone's first since Jules was born. As Arsinoe's stewards, every Malone must attend. Beltane, Kate says, is for the young and the obligated.
Will we see Joseph first? Arsinoe asks.
Jules wrinkles her nose.
To make him come shopping?
There is no reason we ought to suffer alone. He and I can try on jackets and get kicked out of Murrow's for eating crab claws. It'll be grand.
All right, Jules says. He will not be on the boats anyway.
Joseph will not be on the boats for a very long while. It did not sit well with anyone to nearly lose him so soon after he was regained, least of all with his mother. She has grounded him and Jonah both and set them instead to working in the shipyard.
Even Matthew has been restricted from going out too far on the Whistler, though that means sacrificing his best runs. Arsinoe inhales warming morning air. Wolf Spring has begun its thaw. Soon enough, the trees will bud, and everyone will be in much finer spirits.
Wait! Jules? Arsinoe?
A petite black crow soars overhead and wheels around to flap twice in Jules's face.
Aria!
Jules sputters. Camden rears up to half-heartedly swat the bird, but the crow is too fast and makes it back to land at Madrigal's feet.
I'm coming with you, Madrigal says.
She looks very pretty in a light blue dress and tall brown boots. Her hair is curled and bounces around her shoulders. Over her arm is a basket, draped in white cloth. Arsinoe smells baked bread.
What for? Jules asks.
I know more about gowns than either of you, she says, and it is too fine a day to spend indoors. Jules and Arsinoe look at each other and sigh. After the poor night of sleep, neither has the energy to argue. They find Joseph with Matthew, talking on the deck of the Whistler.
Here they come, Matthew says with a broad smile. Three of our favorite girls.
Matthew Sandrin, Jules says, casting a glance at her mother. You are too polite.
But she grins when Joseph jumps onto the dock and pulls her close.
They are very sweet, says Madrigal.
They are indeed, though I could stand to see less of it, Matthew says, and tosses a coil of rope at Joseph's head.
We've come to take him away from you, says Arsinoe.
And what will you give me in return? Your pretty company while I bring in the crab pots.
Arsinoe blushes.
Matthew Sandrin is the only boy who has ever been able to make her blush. How she used to envy Aunt Kara, even as a child.
Perhaps this will do for a trade.
Madrigal holds out her basket. Fresh oat bread and some cured ham. Two ripened hothouse tomatoes, the best we had. I ripened them myself.
Matthew leans over to take the basket.
Thank you, he says. This is unexpected.
I will come back for the basket later, says Madrigal. Will your run be long?
Not with my mother watching.
Come on, Jules waves her hand. If we get this over with soon enough, we can still make it to Luke's for tea.
Their destination is Murrow's Outfitters, the only likely place to find festival clothes suitable for a queen.
Maybe one of those lace ones, Joseph suggests, once they are inside,
and Arsinoe grasps one by the sleeve.
Lace,
she mutters, sing-songy.
Lace, lace, I will strike you in the face.
Not lace, then, he says.
But there is not much to choose from. What dresses they have are plain cotton things in blues and greens. Will you need something? Arsinoe asks, and holds a jacket up to his chest. Perhaps for the hunt.
For the feast, you mean, Madrigal says. Naturalist boys will be shirtless for the hunt, bare-chested except for the symbols we paint on them.
As this is your first Beltane, Jules, you had best think of some pretty markings for Joseph.
She smiles and holds a dress up to Jules, who swats it away much like her cougar would.
Will Matthew join the hunt this year?
I don't know, says Joseph.
He may not. He says it is for the young.
But Matthew is not old. He cannot be more than 30.
Joseph squeezes Jules's hand. Matthew is only 27, the same age as Luke. But Luke seems much younger. He has not known the sadness that Matthew has, the loss. All of Matthew's years must have felt long after they took away Kara.
I'm going to go talk to the clerk. Joseph announces,
perhaps they can still have things brought in from Indrid Down, if the fear of poisoned dresses has not taken hold yet.
He doesn't seem different to me, Arsinoe whispers to Jules after he is gone.
Perhaps you are right, Jules says. Why don't you take him and get out of here for a little while? We are not having any luck.
Are you sure?
Jules glances at her mother.
I can stay.
Go. Arsinoe says, and grimaces at a dress of lace and black ribbons.
That way you can witness my shame for the first time at the disembarking, like everyone else.
Jules nudges her shoulder, and Arsinoe watches as she goes to whisper into Joseph's ear some foolish lover's talk that she cannot ever imagine saying herself. Of course Jules is wrong. Joseph may have done his share of looking, but he has only ever had one girl in his heart. Except, as they leave the shop, Arsinoe catches Joseph's guilty reflection in the glass of the window.
Arsinoe? Madrigal asks. What's the matter?
Nothing, she says, but she grasps Madrigal by the wrist. That first spell, beneath the tree, when Joseph came home, that did not come to pass. That was destroyed, wasn't it?
I do not know, Madrigal answers. I warned you not to burn it.
She had not warned her not to burn it, Arsinoe remembers, as she and Madrigal walk through the streets toward the square at Gillespie's bookshop. She had only suggested she should not have, after the charm had already been burned. Low magic will come back to bite. How many times has she heard that, and in how many voices? From Jules and from Kate, long ago from Kara. What if we did some kind of harm, she asks. Some kind of wrong, to Joseph and Jules.
If you did, there is nothing to be done about it now, Madrigal says. It will work its will, out in the world. Whatever you did has to be born.
She shoves Arsinoe playfully. My Jules is in love and happy. You are worrying for nothing. But all through Luke's excellent tea service of poppy seed cake and diced chicken sandwiches, it is all she can think about. When Madrigal excuses herself to go to the docks to check on Matthew's afternoon catch, Arsinoe barely hears her.
You know, Luke says,
and the way he twists Hank's tail feathers tells her he has been working up to this for the last several minutes.
All this searching through Murrow's is a waste, when I could make you something twice as good as anything from his tailors.
Arsinoe looks at Luke and grins.
Luke! That's brilliant, she says. I do need you to make the most beautiful dress that anyone has ever seen. I just need you to make it to fit Jules.
Jules and Joseph sit beside Dogwood Pond on a wide, dead log, while Camden paws at melting ice chunks to lick the water off her pads. Now that it is thawing, the pond is not as pretty as it was in hard winter. It is muddy and soggy and smells of decomposing plants. But it is still their place, the same place they have been sneaking away to since they were children.
I don't think Arsinoe will ever find a dress, Joseph says.
He throws a waterlogged stick into the open water near the pond's center.
Or if she does, I don't think Kate will be able to get her to wear it.
I don't think it will matter, says Jules, if she has no gift to show at the quickening. The other day I asked her what she was going to perform, and she said she was planning on gutting fish, making fillets.
Joseph chuckles. That's our Arsinoe, he says.
She is insufferable sometimes. Joseph holds Jules's hand and kisses it. It does not need to be bandaged anymore. The cuts from Arsinoe's spell have nearly healed, but she keeps it covered anyway, as Arsinoe keeps her own arm and hand hidden when she is in town.
Madrigal should be strung up for getting her involved in this, Joseph says.
Yes, she should, Jules agrees. Though I mind it less, since it brought you home. And less, too, since it has given Arsinoe hope. Let it keep her safe, until her real gift comes. Isn't that what you and the cat are supposed to be for?
So everyone says.
Jules and Camden have been guardians to the Queen for a long time, and they will continue to be. Until it is over, one way or another. Still, she does not have much time. She had best think of something, and it had best be grand. Beltane is only a few weeks away. Joseph looks down. She and Joseph have planned to be together the first night of the festival. They have come very close already, in his bedroom or pressed into the mattress in the belly of the mainland boat. But Jules wanted to wait. She is a Beltane begot, and somehow she has always thought that her first time with Joseph would be at Beltane.
I know you don't like to think about it, Joseph says. But do you ever wonder what will happen if Arsinoe loses? What your life will be like? Jules plucks dead reeds beside the log and twists them. He did not say killed, but that is what it means. And part of Jules has secretly thought that if Arsinoe died, she would find a way to die right along with her, that she would be there, fighting. I have not thought about it often, she says, but I have. It doesn't seem like we should go on after that, but we will. I suppose I'll take over the house, the fields and the orchard. Goddess knows Madrigal isn't going to do it. She might. You don't know, and that would leave you free to think about other things. What other things? There's a whole other world out there, Jules. You mean the mainland, she says. It's not so bad. There are parts of it that are astounding. Do you want to go back there? No, Joseph says and takes her hand. I would never, unless you wanted to. I'm just saying that if our world ends here, we could start over again, out there. He lowers his head. I don't know why I'm talking about this, why I'm thinking about it. Joseph, she says and kisses his ear. What is the matter? I don't want to lie to you, Jules. But I don't want to hurt you either. He stands abruptly and walks to the edge of the pond. Something did happen the night that Mirabella saved me. He stuffs his hands into his pockets and stares out at the water. I was almost drowned, freezing cold, delirious. He stops and then curses under his breath. Ah, Jules, I don't want to sound as though I'm making excuses. Excuses for what? Jules asks quietly. He turns to face her. I was delirious, at first, he says. Maybe even when it started. But then I wasn't. And she was there, and I was there, and we... You what? I didn't mean for it to happen, Jules. Perhaps not, but it had. Jules, God, Jules, please say something. What would you have me say? She asks. It is difficult to think. Her body is numb, made of the same wood she sits on. A warm weight presses into her lap. Camden's heavy head. A growl that is aimed at Joseph rumbles in her throat. Call me some horrible name, Joseph says. Tell me what a fool I am. Tell me you hate me. I could never hate you, she says. But if you do not leave now, my cat will tear your throat out. Rolandth.
Come away from that window, Mira, Luca says, and try this on.
Mirabella gazes a few more seconds down at the cliffs of the Blackway, where she and Bree often held foot races as girls. Bree grew out of it, but Mirabella never had. Her love of the wind and the open spaces brought her to the edge of those cliffs often, or at least it did, before every door was locked. What for? Mirabella asks. It is not much, and it can be tightened. It will fit. Luca sets the garments down. They are the clothes Mirabella will wear the night of the quickening ceremony. Two gathered black bands of fabric that will be soaked and re-soaked in a boil of herbs and extracts to keep them from burning off her body. For the quickening ceremony, she will perform a fire dance. What will the music be? Mirabella asks. Strings? Flutes?
Drums, Luca replies. A long line of great skin drums to roll out a rhythm for you like a heartbeat.
Mirabella nods.
It will be beautiful, Luca goes on.
She lights a lamp with a long tapered candle and leaves the top open.
The nighttime ceremony and the fire glowing orange. Every eye on the island will be on you.
Yes, Mirabella says.
Mira, Luca says and sighs. What is wrong with you?
The High Priestess's tone is sympathetic, but it is also frustrated, as if she cannot understand why Mirabella should be unhappy, as if Mirabella should be glad to be home and captured, grateful that that she was not whipped in the square. But though Luca knows what happened on the road, how she met her sister and held out her hand, she does not know everything. She does not know that Mirabella also